Accession number 28699, Reel 7.
Mr. Casey, Reel 7. Do you recall, prior to Langevin, immediately prior, as you know, you took your positions to move into the action, that you had considerable air support from typhoons and things?
Well, not particularly. It doesn't really hit on. I mean, I suppose we did, as we were moving along, you know, to different places, different little actions. I mean, really, you went along, and it was more or less the same each day, and you'd make some progress, and you'd get a few casualties, and there was air support, yes. What I do remember about support was when we went into Langevin, the artillery was landing amongst our own men at one point, so we had to stop and wait for it to move on.
Do you recall tanks being with you in Langevin?
Yes, they came up. I remember when I was in position, I went back, the company commander asked me to come back, and I told him exactly where we were, etc. And two or three Sherman tanks came up, I think they were Shermans, and eventually they did knock out a couple of the German tanks, but normally they were totally outgunned with the German 88s, but they managed to get round and achieve something. But when we saw them, I thought, well, if you just come out, you've got no chance, because the 88s will just go straight through you.
Did you suffer any losses in your particular platoon?
Oh, yes. Well, my first one was my sergeant. We'd just gone down into Langevin, and I'd told the section leaders to go in the hedgerows on different sides, and my runner had gone to check everything, and he came back, and I was kneeling on one knee, and he was standing in front of me reporting when two Tiger tanks whipped round the corner and opened fire, and they killed the runner who was standing up in front of me talking to me, and the sergeant was about 10-12 yards further back, and they blew his head off, and we all dived through the hedgerow, because when the shells landed, they say they killed the runner in front of me, and all the dust and muck blew in your face, and I can remember to this day diving through the hedge thinking, I hope to God I'm not blind, and I opened my eyes and I could see, and I thought, thank God. And we lay there for, I don't know, 20 seconds, 30 seconds or something. And I saw the two Piat men with an anti-tank Piat were by my side. And I said, where's the Piat? And they said, it's through the hedge. So I crawled back through the hedge, and the Piat was smashed up. And I looked, and there was one man lying down, motionless, and my Batman. So I got hold of him, and he opened his eyes. I said, are you hit? He said, no. I said, well, get out of the bloody place then. And he was petrified. He just couldn't move. Anyway, we got back. And then that's when I went back to see Rumble, Major Rumble. And, you know, I said what had happened. And he said, oh, the colonel's just been on, and he wants somebody to go and try and find A and B companies, and the 6th, I think, or the 8th, I can't remember, 6th or 8th battalion, who were on our left, I think it was the 6th. And I said, well, my sergeant's just been killed. And he said, well, the other two officers have been killed, so you'll have to go. I thought, well, why didn't your second in command go? Anyway, he said I had to go, so I took one man with me, who was a marvellous soldier, sniper.
What was his name, do you remember?
I cannot remember, you know, it's terrible that, but I can't. But he was killed later. But he went with me, and we went along little trails, went past where A Company had been, and there were bodies all over. Just, I never saw anybody alive. They were just lying there, bodies. And B Company, I suppose, as well. And we finally got to the 6th. We saw one or two tanks, German tanks, moving around. And once we were walking up a little bridle path, and we saw four Germans sitting down, making coffee. And when they spotted us, they ran back to their tank. We ran the other way. And I said to the lad afterwards, I said, they probably thought we were the first of a battalion arriving. Anyway, got to the colonel, and I told him the situation. And he said, well, what about your platoon? And I said, my sergeant's been killed. And he said, well, what the hell are you doing here? I said, the fella who told me to come here has got a crown on his shoulder. I only have two pips, so I go. And he said, who is it? And I said, Major Rumble. He said, oh, God, shambles. I slung him out of my battalion. Get back as fast as you can, son. And when I came back, I was near to the position, and my platoon were coming out. And a corporal in charge, and I stopped him. I said, what the hell are you doing? He said, we've been told to withdraw. I said, no, you can't withdraw. We've got to stay here. He said, well, that's what Shambles has said. I said, you're going back. So I made them come back to the hedgerow, and I went to see Shambles. I said, what the hell's going on? He said, I just told them to withdraw to this position here. I said, well, they didn't understand you, and they were all off.
What were you defending? You said you were in the hedgerow. Was it a road you were defending?
No, yes, there was a road, and we were either side of it in the hedgerows, the thought being that the infantry would come. But it's very unusual. The tanks counterattacked the German tanks with no infantry. And we presumed infantry would be following them. And so we just got as good firing positions as we could for when the infantry started coming through. But they never did.
And the German tanks, they obviously didn't break through you.
They were on the road, just on the little bend. And eventually, I think, I don't know whether John Mogg got one with somebody. He was second in command then. And I think certainly our tanks got one of them. So I don't know how many German tanks there were. I only knew the two that came round first. That was enough. But we finished up back in the hedgerow, me with all my platoon and with a corporal instead of a sergeant.
Going into action, it was really your first major action.
You
know, before that there'd been kind of skirmishes.
That's right.
Did you realise, just on the point of going in, that it was going to be tough? Had you any indication that things were going to be difficult?
No, I mean, afterwards we learned what everybody knows, that the colonel then had said to the brigadier, you have a lot of casualties if you go in the daylight, and he was right. But nobody had told us that. We were just going to get this village, and to go into this village. And the cornfields, and the last, I think, opposite A Company and B Company, whoever was in front, I've forgotten now, they cut the corn about 50 yards from the woods, and they were all lying down with the machine guns pointing out, pulling a string.
Moving into action, did you move in the long lines of, you know, bayonets fixed and so forth?
Yes, yes.
So kind of a First World War type attack.
It was,
or
really.
A desert attack.
Yes, it was really. And, you know, I mean, we weren't all in one line, but it was in lines, you know. And we had no idea, really, that it was going to be anything as heavy as that. And, of course, it was tanks that really did the trouble. I mean, and I suppose it was artillery and against us.
Did you know which German units you were facing?
No.
Probably found that out afterwards.
No, I didn't know. Didn't know.
So I think it was a pretty first-class German outfit.
Oh, I think so, yes. Into. Yes. I mean, they certainly made a mess of us. We lost, 200-odd men and 22 officers, I think, that day.
And the role of a platoon commander, you know, you're under fire, the men obviously are nervous. What kind of, did you see yourself, what kind of duty you had to carry out with them as you did this fighting?
I found a lot of my well, not a lot, quite a few of my men had been in the desert and so on, and they didn't want to know about getting killed. The ones who'd never done anything, they were quite ready to go. But I found, as I explained when I was in England on a course, and they were telling me how you're supposed to, infantry is supposed to move in attacks, and I said, well, I found you go in front with what, if you're doing night patrols, you take one man and you go in front, and the other eight or nine catch you up every 100 yards, because otherwise they sound like elephants charging through the jungle. In an attack, you went in front and the sergeant went in the back, and he made sure everybody came. I don't know whether, did I tell you about Pierre Jordan, the sergeant, who became my sergeant, but he was a section commander at first. I told you about him, didn't I?
Yes, he was just a young lad, wasn't he? Just a young chap,
was
he?
Yeah, young, and when we did this attack, the section came through, and then his section, it was just him and one other fella. And I didn't notice that he had a couple of extra rifles and a Bren gun on him. And I turned round, and it was a beautiful sunny day, and we were I was in front, and there was nobody in front of us to shoot at, but they were shooting at us from hills on either side. And I turned round and started calling him.
Yes, we have got this, I remember. Ah, yes, we have got this.
Because then he said, resurrect him, yeah.
The battlefield's a pretty frightening and noisy place, no doubt.
Well, I always said that it was easier for an officer than other ranks, because when you're doing an attack like that or any other, you've got to think about so many things. Is he up? Are the section there? Is this sergeant doing? Is he coming up? A bloke on his own, a private, all he has to think about is, am I going to get killed? And I always found that you had so much to occupy your mind, you really didn't have time to get really scared, because you're thinking, you know, what's happening to that? What's happening to this section? And if we're firing, you know, we want some fire on there, we want some fire. So you're very busy. And thank God for that. You didn't really have as much time to get scared. I think the most frightening thing for me was doing night patrols, because it's silence, and you know, if you're doing fighting patrols where you're hoping to get a prisoner if you can, you're just presuming they're going to be there, and they're going to know you're coming before you know they're there, so they're going to get the first shot. So that was very nerve-wracking.
Some men, as you've intimated, really, with the veterans in your platoon and the young ones, some men you must have had to persuade to go with you, as against others that were others in the group that were keen to get on.
Well, I remember that thing I was talking about when Pierre Jordan, corporal, was in that battle. As I say, we were a beautiful sunny day. We were going across this ground, and they're just firing at us from either side, tanks and mortars. And one lad goes down, and he won't get up. So, man, it's like whatever happened. I pulled my revolver and I said, "Get up, and you're going with me, or I'll bloody shoot you now." So he got up, and we got to the objective, and he was absolutely full of beans. He was over the moon. "We did it, sir, we did it." I said, "Yeah, of course we did, good lad, you know." But he didn't want to go. I mean, he didn't want to get killed, you know, that was it. And the other thing, on that same thing, there was somebody wounded in a stomach wound, and there's not much you can do. You give him morphine or whatever you had, you know, but you can't give him water, you can't, you know. But this lad is lying there in agony, and everybody's kind of celebrating, because you've got there, and you've lost a few men, but the rest of you have made it, and it's like somebody's throwing a party almost.
It's an enormous relief to have...
Yeah, incredible.
Reach the objective,
that you're there and you're still alive. And this poor lad, you know, for a few seconds, you kind of ignored him, and then you suddenly realise, and you get, you know, you had these little things like lighter fuel things with morphine in that you stuck in plastic holders and pressed it, and then wrote M on his forehead so that the stretchy bearers knew he'd had some morphine. But the first reaction was just elation. And anything like that, you know, you
was that an attitude that I suppose most soldiers in action have towards wounded and killed men, that yes, it's your friend, etc., but the relief that you're still there, you're
yes,
still alive.
Yes, yes. And sometimes, you know, afterwards you'd be ashamed. But when it happened, you had this feeling of exultation that you'd got there and you'd made it.
When the whole action was over, and you were relieved by the Gloucesters, I think it was.
Yes, yeah.
What was the reaction then? You went into a rest situation. What was the first reaction after being through so much tension and stress?
Well, the first reaction was relief. Thank God we're out of it. But then you know you were depressed then. At least certainly anybody who was at any sort of command was depressed, because you realised what had happened to the other lads, you know, and how many lads had gone. And you couldn't remember their names. There were so many of them. You know, there were, in my platoon, the two other subalterns had been killed. My best friend had been killed the night before. So then, you went back and, where's the bottle? You know, and that's it.
Sleep, was sleep an important element?
Oh, yes, yes. You'd just flop. Because you'd been at it and been drained, I suppose. And you just flop down and went out like a light. And then the next day, you know, you kind of try to enjoy everything that's there rather than just being miserable.
Was there any people who could get away to buy you for a day or two or someplace like that behind the lines?
No, we didn't. We just, I think, I have a feeling that we had things like the bath unit came up and that, and so you actually were able to lie down in a canvas bath and maybe get a change of clothes or something, you know. I mean, in my case, I had a pack of stuff, you know, which you could then change things. But simple things became so important, like having a bath or something. I can remember when we got to Lille, it was such a wonderful thing to go into this house that was empty. And I opened this door, and it was quite, it was about 8 feet long to this toilet that was raised. And to sit on that toilet was absolute luxury beyond imagining. Never forgotten it.
The battalion lost a lot of men.
Oh, yes.
Well over 200.
220 odd men and 22 officers.
You'd get new drafts. Where were they coming from?
Well, I don't know, they just arrived very quickly. We just, it seemed to happen all the way through. We just must have gone through a hell of a lot of men in the 9th. I think we went through about two or three battalions of men by the time we got to Berlin. And the two things, I suppose, first of all, because there were so many, but also because you didn't become attached to people so much that you couldn't remember names and so on. There were just a few, you know, like one of my friends there was Peter Pilbeam, who died about 3 months ago. He was a company commander eventually, and he and I were great friends. But most of them, you just didn't remember names, and especially amongst the other ranks, because there were so many, and they came and they went, and you know.
This was Major Moggs taking over from
Colonel Woods, right,
in the
yeah.
middle of the battle. Mm. It was his first command. He hadn't been with you long anyway.
No.
We were able to come to some conclusion as to the type of officer he was going to turn out to be, commanding the battalion.
Not that day, but in the next short period, He seemed to be great. You know, he thought he was going to be great. And also, sensible. Now, the first colonel was, I suppose, a great bloke. He was certainly great when we were in England for parties and everything. And then over there, he was incredibly brave. In fact, I said to somebody after Longyearbyen, I said, well, if he hadn't been killed today, he was going to be killed for sure. Because you don't, you know, sit on top of a carrier and wave your baton, you know. Now, Mogg, he was brave, but sensible. When he had to do it, he did it. There was once when we were house clearing, and it's a very slow process, and he knew it had to go on quicker, and he figured there weren't any troops there. So he went in front of the fellas and just walked in the houses on his own, and they followed him, and then he said, right, come on, it's bloody clear, get on with it. Now, you know, that was brave, but he figured it out. But on another occasion, it was funny because he was a bit shamefaced. He'd come up to see me when I had a carrier platoon, and we'd dug in, and we were counterattacked, and then it settled down. We dealt with that, and then we were getting occasional mortars, you see. Now, he hadn't been dealing with mortars personally, I suppose, but he came up and he's standing there, and my slit trench is here, and there's some mortars coming over, moaning minis, he used to call them, and he dived in the slit trench, you see, and I didn't. And he came up and I said, those weren't for us, sir. I'll tell you what, I'll be in first, weren't they for us? And he was very embarrassed because he jumped in the slit trench and I hadn't. And that's when I came across one of my fellas who had captured some Germans in this attack. And he was a fella who we thought of as a very, very old man. He was about 40. And one of my lads was digging another slit trench, you see. And I said, what the hell are you doing? He said, I'm digging the slit trench from. He said, poor old sod. He said, he just showed me photographs of his family. I was showing him mine. And he was digging his father a slit trench, this prisoner, because he thought he was a bit old to be digging. And quite strange episodes.
Mogg's personality obviously, you know, imposed itself on the baton.
Yeah.
I'm thinking more now of his character and his personality. What was he like in that respect?
Oh, everybody likes him. He came over as a very likeable, knowledgeable man, who did what was necessary. He wasn't foolhardy, but he was brave when he had to be. And he understood things, you know. And he had a sense of humour. That was the other thing. Because he and I had a lot of amusing little things, really, considering I was only a lieutenant. Even when I was commanding doing the carrier platoon, I was still only a lieutenant. The snow on the ground, and we were had to cross a river and to do this attack. And he said, well, the carriers can't cross. And I thought, thank God for that. So he said, get 30 of your men, and you act as my battalion headquarters guard. So I thought, oh God, all right. So I turned up wearing what they used to wear in the prison carriers, see, which was riding boots, a pair of riding breeches sort of thing, and a beret, and a brown zip jacket, you see. He said, what the hell are you dressed for? I said, well, this is what... Well, he had a white tank suit, but he also had a white smock. So he gave me the smock. He said, put that on. He said, when they see you, they'll think you're a bloody general, and they'll try to shoot you, and they might miss it at me. And so I wore his white smock. So, you know, there's funny things like that. And also, he told me one day, when I'd left the platoon and I was in charge of the carriers, as I was going past my old platoon, who were getting into trucks, I was walking with the colonel, and they started singing Cowboy. It was a song called Cowboy, he's a real lum-dinger, he's a merry, merry swing. And I said, huh, just that. He said, well, it's your platoon. I said, yeah. He said, well, it's you they're singing about. I said, you what? He said, that's what they call you, Cowboy Casey. I said, well, he said, well, you've got two bloody guns, haven't you? And I had a German pistol as well as my own. He said, oh, it's you they're singing about. So he knew, I didn't know. So
just really briefly on drafts, which you know you obviously knew they were coming. Was there any indication, increasingly from Rangier, that they were scraping the barrel on quality troops? You know, from England, they were really getting down in numbers. I'm thinking in terms of some of the men, John, you may have been from the corps rather from infantry background.
Not that I was aware of, really. You really didn't get that involved, because you know you've lost 200 odd men and then another 200 turn up and you're allocated so many, and you really weren't concerned with where they've been or where they come from, just you know where they're going to fit in to the platoon and would they do it what you wanted and so on. And I used to try and get a friendly spirit in the platoon. In fact, when I took over the carriers, and we had to paint the carriers, I gave them all names, and on the front, where you used to drop the thing down and use the Bren gun, there was a little flap, and you put the initial on the flap of the name, and I arranged it, so when you lined them all up, they read Casey's Cowboys.